I'm joined now by Greene County historian Sylvia Hasenkopf. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well.
What's going on in the history of Greene County today?
Well, today, I don't know. There's quite a bit on my table anyways in terms of doing local research, and that makes it great fun. But I just finished up my 250th article for the Greeneville Pioneer. I write a historical column for that paper since May the 20th, 2010.
That's every other week, so it'll be out this Friday,
it'll
right?
It'll be out this Friday, absolutely.
What's the column on? Is it
It's the second part of the story of Ned Buntline.
Who's Ned Buntline?
I know. How it started off was I was having a conversation with Robert Marengolo, who opened up Pizza Michelina's in Cairo this summer. And
where is that?
It's right at the the corner opposite Slater's. There's that little corner. He has a trailer there.
Yeah, I know where you're talking
about.
Now,
so
yes.
He makes wood-fired pizza and all that kind of stuff. So I stopped to talk to Robert because I've talked to him on a number of other things. And he says, hey, do you know that you should check out Ned Buntline? I go, and who is Ned Buntline? I've never heard of him. And he goes,
yeah, usually there's a street or something named around somebody that's a famous old name around here.
Yeah, and so Ned Buntline isn't even a real name of somebody. It's actually the nom de plume of Edward Zane Carroll Judson, who was probably the inventor of the dime novel in the 19th century. And Robert said to me, he says, you should check him out. He's a pretty interesting character. He was born and died in Stamford, Delaware County. And his wife died at the Greene County poorhouse. I said, okay, well, there's my local link. I've got to check this out because I love these intriguing little stories. And so I started to do a fair amount of research on Ned Buntline and Edward. And so this is the second part of that article, describing, his career, his exploits. He was an incredible writer. He was a prolific writer. He told tall tales. He's credited with really inventing the whole idea of our mythologized, or however you say that properly, Wild Wild West. That kind of crazy thing, with Wild Bill Hickok and,
So he was here in Greene County writing stories about the...
Not in Greene County. He was in Delaware. And he left quite young. Actually, his father ended up becoming a lawyer in Philadelphia and then moved to Pittsburgh. But Ned was all over the place. He was a midshipman, and then he was in the U.S. Navy, and then he went riding out west with the buffalo, started writing his stories. Daring Do is part of his name. And along with that came the whole reputation of being somewhat of a rascal. I found at least 7 marriages. I think there were more. Some of them he was married to the same woman at the same time.
I was going to say,
two women
were
at the
there
same
at least
time.
6 divorces?
I've only found 2 divorces out of all of those. Two passed away. He was actually one of the ringleaders of the Astor Place Opera House riots, which happened when there was this whole nativist thing that was going on in the late 1840s and early 50s. And Ned Buntline, as he was known, was a leader of that nativist opinion that we shouldn't have any foreigners in the country. And what was going on in New York City was there was an English actor, MacReady, who was really a thespian. He was well-known Shakespearean actor, playing Macbeth at the Astor Place Opera House. And then there was another American, who I can't remember his name offhand, who was playing at another theater, also Macbeth. And Ned Buntline basically took the opportunity to create a huge to-do over that and led a riot. People were pounding on the doors of the opera house, screaming and yelling that they didn't need Englishmen here playing in American soil.
Sounds like that scene in Gangs of New York.
Kind of, yeah. And it was around the same time. So, he ended up causing the deaths of between... I think it was up to 21 people, and over 120 were wounded. He was caught. He was fined $250. He was imprisoned.
Fined $250 for causing the deaths of 21 people?
Right. Well, inciting the riot.
Inciting, right. But still.
Yes. And $250 back then was a fair amount of change. But he also was incarcerated at Blackwell's Island for a whole year, and that was the prison system there. So
that was the Rikers Island of the day, I guess.
Yes, yeah. It was. Black Hills is not a good place to be, but he managed to survive, and while there, he wrote his stories. He wrote more stories. And so that's what he did. He wrote a lot of tall tales about pirates on the high seas, about being a seaman on the high seas, of being a Wild West person, whether it was a buffalo hunter. He also was the person credited with kind of inventing the story of Buffalo Bill, because he actually met the real character, who was a buffalo hunter, and basically coined the term Buffalo Bill. And wrote stories about him. And that's how William Frederick Cody, who was Buffalo Bill, came known to the public. And then Ned Buntline wrote a play about him, which was a horrible play, panned by the critics, hugely popular across the U.S., played for years across the country. And Ned Buntline was in it, Buffalo Bill Cody was in it, Texas Jack was in it, and then an Italian ballerina by the name of Gia Sapini, and I can't remember her last name, but it was a very long Italian name, played the Indian princess. And it was hugely popular all over the place. And that cemented Buffalo Bill's reputation and, you know, public recognition across the country. So that was the foundation of his Buffalo Bill Wild West show that went on later on. So he was really, you know, Ned Buntline was a very interesting character. He was said to have earned over $20,000 a year writing these pulp fiction. And,
which is a lot of money at the time, right?
Hugely. And maybe that's how he could afford all those wives running around in different cities. And then he built this Eagle's Nest out in Stamford. It was a beautiful home where he retired and eventually died.
Is it still there?
I think it burned down, from what I understand. There's also a great story. It was, coincidentally, I was writing these stories while the new publication, the Catskill Tri-County publication, was coming out. It's a new journal being put out by the, I believe it's the Gilboa Historical Society, and it's like 90 to 100 pages of Greene County, Schoharie County, and Delaware County history. So someone else was writing about the Ned Buntline, but from the Wild West show perspective. So we were doing it at the same time. Mine is like his whole life, and I didn't spend a huge amount of time in his Wild West days, but their story talks a great deal about the Wild West days. So combine the two, you get a really good overview of Edward Zane Carroll Judson, a.k.a. Ned Buntline.
So there's a new historical journal coming out?
Yes, it's out. Its second publication just came out. It's very easily one of the best journals that have come out in a long time on local history.
What is it called?
It's the Catskill Tri-County, I think it's Historical Journal is the final part of it. Very well written, very well done. Contact the Gilboa Historical Society or contact me.
Is it available anywhere locally? Or?
I think it's right now through subscription. It's very, very reasonable and well worth, you know, getting. I absolutely enjoyed the articles. They pick interesting stories that nobody knows about, kind of like what I do with Greene County. They keep wanting me to write, and when I have some spare moments, I will actually write for them as well. It's well done, and it covers stories from all three counties.
So now you're celebrating 250
articles. That's hard to believe.
That's a lot of history, huh?
That is a tremendous amount of history. And I, you know, as I sat there finishing up the article for this week, I said to myself, you know, really, who would have thought, you know, when I started this journey back in May 20th of 2010, that I would still be doing this all these years later. And how that all happened was Andrea Macko, who's the owner of the Greenville Pioneer, the publisher and editor. I met her by chance at the Vetter Research Library, and she had been going in there to look for some images or some information for her first issue of this newspaper. And I looked at her.
The newspaper just started at the same time, too.
Yeah, and I said, do you want a historical column? And she looked at me and she goes, absolutely. So I've been with them since the very first issue. And that makes it kind of fun because I feel like I've grown with the paper. I mean, when I started out, my column was like 750 words. You know, it's just a small column, and now I take a whole page. So it's like 2,000 words, 2,500 words, you know, and so there's a fair amount of research that goes into each one of the articles that I write. And they are about things that affect Greene County. 99% of the articles are about something that happened in or around Greene County, a person, events, a place. A few of them have to do with, if you want to research your historical roots, like Revolutionary War roots and that sort of thing. And I will give a little story about, you know, that so that people know what to actually research when they want to find out those things. But most of the stories are literally just about this area. And there's lots more stories to be told, to be honest with you.
Do you have some favorites over the years? Or
there are a few. There's one that has resonated me, and it actually was my 29th article in the newspaper. And it's one that I still to this day, after all these articles, look back on and go, that's the one that I thought was surprised me the most. And it really had to do with the fact that I was doing some research at the Vedder Library, and I came across an article in the Catskill Packet in September of 1794. And, of course, the Catskill Packet was started in 1792.
That was a newspaper?
It was a newspaper, and it's run pretty continuously since that date to today's Daily Mail. You know, there's been a couple of times where it's had a month or two off because of a change of ownership, but it's really the continuous newspaper has run for, surprisingly, over 200 years. I think that's pretty awesome, actually. And so I saw this ad, and it was about a bunch of inhabitants in Catskill who were meeting at the local tavern, Mrs. Camp's, on Friday, the 19th of September, 1794. And they were meeting to discuss the upcoming smallpox inoculation that was going to happen in the village. And, you know, Stephen Day, who was the chairman of the meeting, was, you know, one of the movers and shakers of Catskill at that time. Was, you know, chairing the meeting, and the vast majority of the people that were there, frankly, were alarmed at the possibility that someone would bring smallpox into their community. And at that time, one has to remember, smallpox was a very, very scary thing, because you could catch it through inhalation. You could catch it from touching contaminated clothing or a person. It was very easily transmitted. So it was a very scary thing. And, you know, the people were afraid.
So people were probably afraid of newcomers coming into town.
Yes. And, you know, I sat to myself and said, wow, you know, I remember getting my smallpox inoculation back in the day, my vaccination, I should say, back in the day when I was in school. And we don't need to do it anymore because smallpox is really the only human disease that's been eradicated around the world. I think we're getting close with tuberculosis, but I don't think it's quite done yet. But, you know, smallpox has been eradicated since the 1970s. So I was probably in the last group of school kids that actually was inoculated and have the scar still to prove it. But the people there were quite afraid because when you think about it, during the Revolution in the 1770s, the last major smallpox epidemic had happened, and an estimated 125,000 people died. Many, many more survived. But were horribly scarred on their faces and their bodies with the smallpox, you know, scars. So the whole memory of getting smallpox in a community was still incredibly fresh in everybody's minds. So they were worried about this. And I said, well, I still don't understand why they were afraid of getting the inoculation. If it was going to save them, why would they say no? So one has to understand how smallpox really came to be. And smallpox was a name that was given to this disease where you got these pustules on your face and it looked like huge pimples full of pus all over the place. And it was called smallpox because they had the great pox. The great pox was syphilis. And syphilis was actually a relative newcomer to Europe because it was a disease that developed in North America and South America. It was the America's disease. And it was brought back to Europe by the adventurers who had come to, you know, America. And so they had the great pox and the smallpox. But, you know, the people in Catskill were afraid that bad members of society were working in open violation of the safety of their community. So these were the words that were being used in the ad. And so I started to do a little bit of research about what smallpox was so I understood it better. And basically, it entered the human population about 10,000 years before Christ. So smallpox has been around a long time. And it was probably transmitted from an animal and became a human disease, a uniquely human disease. And during the 18th century, worldwide, it's estimated that smallpox had killed 400,000 people in Europe alone, and that it was responsible for 300 to 500 million deaths worldwide in the 20th century. So it was really quite a scary disease. Between 20 and 60% of people infected with smallpox variola died from the disease, and over 80% of children that were infected with the disease also died. So if you didn't die, you were left with those scars. So the other thing that could happen is you could end up being permanently blind because that somehow did something to your eyes. So what was that fear? Why did people not want to get an inoculation that would stop this from happening? Well, it really comes down to the difference between inoculation versus vaccination. And I hadn't realized that there was a difference between the two terms. Inoculation happened when a physician would scratch material from a smallpox lesion of a person who had smallpox actively. So they had to bring someone into the community who actually had smallpox. Then they would open up one of the pustules, take some of that, and then scratch that needle into another person to start the inoculation process.
Well, now we can see the resistance.
So they were afraid that person was somehow going to infect other people in the community, and they would have their own smallpox outbreak in the community. Now, the Chinese had actually been practicing inoculation since the 10th century, and it was a widespread practice by the 16th century all over China, and that's how the Europeans heard about it, was through the traveling that was going on to China at that time for the silk and tea trade. So they had seen this happening, and they brought that back to England. So that's all they knew at that time how to do is, well, we have to bring an infected person into the community, open up one of those things, take the pustules, and scratch somebody. So, yeah, it was pretty scary. But people were still committed to doing that because it was the only way to protect the communities.
So it was probably very difficult. How did they convince people that was really in their best interest?
Because they had success. There were so many people that once they were inoculated that way, did not develop disease and had developed immunity.
It still seems difficult. Like if you take a boat months and months from China, and then you land somewhere and they say, well, over there, it really works. You have to believe me.
Right. And so there was some obvious real resistance at first, but I think there were doctors that believed in it and actually did it to their own families. So then they were able to prove that there was an opportunity to become immune to the disease by doing this process, and it did spread. There was resistance, and usually there was a larger resistance in areas that were less educated. Kathka was somewhat educated, you know, but still it was on the frontier. People were afraid, and so they actually singled out the individuals in the community who were not supporting the inoculation process, and basically said that persons as will not conform to the regulation, which is not to do the inoculation, shall be considered by us as bad citizens. And as far as it lays in our power, we pledge ourselves not to have any intercourse with them or those who refuse to adopt this resolution. So, I mean, three people that were picked out who supported inoculation were Elijah Doty, John Champlin, and Luke Lewis. They were pariahs in their community because of their support of the inoculation process. But not long thereafter, in 1796, Edward Jenner, a British doctor, discovered that immunity to smallpox could also be achieved by inoculating a person with material from a cowpox lesion. And cowpox stemmed from the same family of variola as the smallpox did, and it was much safer because it didn't become smallpox, and that's how vaccinations became. And of course, vacca in Latin is cow. So what we got as kids in school was vaccinations from materials from cowpox rather than smallpox.
And I guess that was a lot more accepted because bringing someone that's infected into the community that could infect other people would just be a scary thing to begin with. But there are all kinds of cows in the area already.
Right. Now, it took a while for that all to, for them to figure out a vaccination process and to prove that that would not create, you know, cause smallpox. But that was the beginning of the vaccination process by using a disease that was similar to a human disease that was in animals and therefore not going to result in the human disease, but would still prevent us from getting the human disease. And they still do that today with other vaccinations that we get.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a good time to remind everyone that's go out and get your flu shot now.
There you go. So that's one of the ones that has resonated with me all these years, simply because it was such a unique story and taught me something about inoculations and vaccinations that surprised me. I had no idea that's how that came to be. And because I experienced it myself as a kid, getting the smallpox vaccine, it just kind of really stuck with me all these years. But that's what research is about at the end of the day. It's finding out all the different stories that you never thought of, or the whys and the wherefores of today's society. It comes from somewhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have another story.
Tell us another story. Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah, thank you. The other one's about Uncle Sam.
And people think of Troy, New York, with Uncle Sam, right?
Absolutely.
But he has the bridge in Catskill is called
the
Uncle Sam Bridge, right?
And there is that tie. And basically, it's because Samuel Wilson, Nathaniel Wilson, and Ebenezer Wilson moved from Arlington, Massachusetts to Troy and set up a slaughterhouse there. And they were operating already in the 18th century, in the late 1700s.
Uncle Sam was a butcher.
Well, the three of them were all involved in the butchering trade, the slaughterhouse business, yes. And they were hugely successful in Troy. In 1812, they had secured the contract with the U.S. government to supply beef and pork to the American army that was serving in the far north during the War of 1812. So they had government inspectors that would come to the factory where the salt beef and pork were being put in barrels for transport up. And his name was Albert Anderson. So he had a stamp that he would take, and after he inspected the barrel, he would stamp it, and it would be EAUS. Now, I guess Samuel, Ebenezer, and Nathaniel were kind of beloved by their workers. They all called them Uncle Sam, Uncle Nat, and Uncle Eben. So some worker said, well, what does that EAUS stand for? And another one quipped, well, it means Albert Anderson and Uncle Sam. And that's how the legend of Uncle Sam began. Because he supplied, you know, salt, beef, and pork to the soldiers serving during the War of 1812. Now,
so a delivery from Uncle Sam was a highlight of the soldiers.
Absolutely, it was food. You know, I mean, it was hard to live up there. It's not like there was a store around every corner like we have today. I mean, you lived off the land, you got food from somewhere, or you went hungry. You know, these are the choices, right? So the legend goes that Uncle Sam actually appeared as a feature in literature as early as 1816. It was called The Adventures of Uncle Sam in Search After His Lost Honor by Frederick Augustus. So that whole legend spread very, very quickly. Oh, sorry, by Frederick Augustus Fidfaddy Esquire. So that was the first time the character of Uncle Sam representing the United States appeared in literature was in 1816. But Samuel and Nathaniel moved to Catskill around 1817 and set up a slaughterhouse down where the old Hoppenose knitting mill used to be, which is on the south side of the creek going towards the river. So do you know where that... What, today all you have left is that brick chimney standing?
Right, yeah.
That's the old Hoppenose knitting mill. So their slaughterhouse was down in that area. And you can imagine they would be slaughtering and all that stuff would be going in the water. You know, the blood, offal, whatever would be, that's how they got rid of stuff. So the creek being tidal, that's how, it was not a pleasant place. So the brothers lived there in the house, though, where the Captain Kidd Tavern is. Do you know where that
yeah,
is?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Because that building was built around 1797.
Wow, that's it, it's it an seems old, like an old building. Yeah.
And so they actually lived there. And in fact, Martin Van Buren, our eighth president, married his wife, Harriet Hose, there in 1807.
Because he lived in Kinderhook?
He was from Kinderhook, yes, absolutely. So they married in that particular building. So we have a little bit of claim to fame.
They wanted the smell of the slaughterhouse at the wedding?
Well, this is they got married in 1807. The slaughterhouse didn't come until 1817.
Oh, it was later. Okay.
Yes, absolutely. Now, they grew their meat packing business. It became very, very successful, of course. So they moved it to the point, closer to the river, because then they could just put the barrels straight on the steamships that were, by that time, we had the steam going. And so they could put them on the steamships, and off they go. Now, the point at that time was an island.
So how did they get there?
Well,
they had to ship cows out there?
Well, when the
tide went out,
it was a muddy flat. Mm. So there was probably a way to get out there. Or they just put them on smaller ships and took them out there. It probably just became easier for transportation purposes to have them, have their slaughterhouse that close to where they were actually going to put them on the ships. So, anyways, what happened then is that Nathaniel then decided, I'm going to get into the brickmaking business, and started to build a brickmaking operations opposite where the Catskill High School is today, along the creek. So he did brickmaking there. And his brother, Samuel, continued to do the meat packing business.
Near the old, what is it, the Black Bridge, or what is it called?
Between the Black Bridge and,
the ice cream shop?
Ice cream shop, yeah. So that would be where the brickmaking, and traditionally it continued to be there well into the early 20th century. We had brickmaking up and down the creek. It was a very, very important industry here. Now, Samuel Wilson, for whom, Uncle Sam is all about, returned to Troy in 1823, where he continued doing the meat packing business until he died there in 1854 at the age of 87. His brother Nathaniel, however, remained a Catskill citizen until his death, also in 1854, the two brothers. So Uncle Nat, who stayed in Catskill, became the inspector of beef and pork for Greene County on September 25th, 1823, and for fish in March 25th, 1831. So he kept his fingers in the business to some degree. Now, Nathaniel Wilson is actually buried in Catskill Village Cemetery up on Thompson Street. So the Wilsons didn't completely leave. We continued having them here for quite some time. But if you want to talk about the symbol Uncle Sam, the first thing that comes to mind is that kind of bearded gentleman with white hair and that goatee.
The hat,
the
usually,
tie,
right?
High hat, and
usually red, white, and blue stripes.
Yes, the red, white, and blue uniform, and his finger sticking out saying, I want you for U.S. Army. It became a recruiting poster. But the character was actually developed by a guy named Thomas Nash, who was a German immigrant, became a political cartoonist, and created that image back in the 1800s, around the Civil War. He's also credited with creating the cartoon of Santa Claus. Because before that, Santa Claus was kind of old Saint Nick, who was a skinny guy. Didn't look anything like the jolly man that we know today. That man,
based on like some 13th century saint or something.
Well, the whole story of Saint Nicholas, we could talk at the next show.
Yeah,
I'll bring that because that is a fun story. He was a jolly, jolly guy, but he wasn't. He was a German thing, And Saint Nick could be a good guy or a bad guy, because in Europe, even my brother, who was born in Austria, he was afraid of what was going to happen, whether he would get coal in a sock because he was a bad boy, or he would get treats in a sock because he was a good boy. So, Saint Nick had a different kind of connotation. You had the Grumpus, who was looked like this devil kind of dude that came around on the 6th of December and let you know whether you were good or bad. And then St. Nick would be the guy that would give you, a present if you were a good boy. But he was always skinny, and he didn't look anything like the Thomas Nast figure that we have today.
So he made him heavy set, yeah.
Fat and jolly. Yes, he did. He also is credited with creating the Democratic donkey and the Republican elephant.
He came up with the idea, or they already existed, but he came up with the drawings.
I think he came up with those drawings, from what I understand. I'd have to do a little bit more research into that one. But I know that what they look like today, that was him.
Because Republicans didn't start until 1860, right? Or Lincoln was one of the the Whigs. When
remember
the Whigs
we were talking about Ned Buntline and that whole nativist movement?
Right.
Did you ever hear of the Know Nothing Party?
Yeah, well, from Gangs of New York again.
Know Nothing Party. We had actually a chapter in Greenville, believe it or not.
We did.
So we cannot say we escaped this whole nativist thing here in Greene County in the 1850s. Well, the Nativist Party became somewhat powerful for about 4 or 5 years. They actually won a lot of governorships. They won a lot of legislative seats and so on. But they imploded. By 1856, the party was no more.
And did they call themselves the Know Nothing Party, or was that everyone else
they
calling
them
that?
They were the, I think it, let me think, it was the American Nativists.
It seems unlikely
party.
That someone would call themselves the Know Nothing
Party. Well, the Know Nothings, so the reason that came is because the early seeds of the Know Nothing Party were in the 1840s. And, do I have that? I might have that here with me. Let me just see quickly. But, oh, I do. Yep, 118. I brought my book, my first book of my stories in the Greenville Pioneer.
What is that book called?
It's called The First 50 Articles from the Greenville Mountain View Pioneer.
So you need to update that with the first 250 articles.
Well, I have a second book out that does more, and I am almost ready to publish the third book now.
Great.
Which, because they're in newspapers and they're ephemera, they get thrown out. This way, the stories and the history won't be lost. So I've kept them, and I'm publishing them as I have time to put them out.
Well, I think they're in the air. You know, people use them to start their fires fireplaces. So the ashes are in the air.
All over the place. But anyways, basically the Know Nothing Party came to be because there was this big fear of immigrants in the mid-1800s, you know. There was, like, between 1845 and 1854, more than 2,900,000 European immigrants landed in the United States.
They came in caravans or...
They came on ships. There was no process to process them. If you came and you didn't have a disease, you were let in. You know, contrary to what people believe today. There was really no immigration policy. There was nothing like...
You weren't applying for asylum.
You were not applying for asylum, but you were fleeing usually religious or political or sectarian strife. You were running away from something to something better, and America was something better. So, you know, we had almost 3 million people arrive in less than 10 years. People were afraid.
The whole country population was much less than today. So 3 million people was like
an incredible amount of people. And they largely, not completely, but largely came through New York City. And that was before Ellis Island.
And which countries were they coming from?
Primarily from Germany and from Ireland.
So we were demonizing German and Irish migrants then.
Absolutely. And we were demonizing them primarily because they were Catholic. Mm. And this was a very Protestant country at that time. And that whole fear of Catholicism in our political system existed right up until John F. Kennedy was elected. That was our first Catholic president. And that was still a fear. Because the fear was that if you elect a Catholic into any political position, that the Pope, in fact, would be running the country. And that was what nativists were saying, was these Catholics are coming in to steal your jobs, are going to steal, you know, our political system, and it is going to be the Pope who runs this country. And it made a lot of people quite afraid. So they gained, you know, for a short period of time, a great deal of power, the nativist movement. And in the early days, if you belonged to this movement, if you were asked if you belonged to it, you were to say, I know nothing.
That's why.
Yes, and there is actually a specific quote that goes along with this. Let me see if I can find it very quickly here. And it was basically, I know nothing but my country, my whole country, and nothing but my country. And that was their secret saying to let people know that they belonged to that party.
Hmm. So it wasn't quite Sergeant Schultz from Hogan's Heroes.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you?
Sergeant Schultz from Hogan's Heroes. It wasn't...
nothing like that. I know nothing. But so anyways, the know-nothings were an important thing, but by 1856, they literally had imploded from within.
Yeah, so because there's parallels to what's going on today.
Absolutely.
What was the reason they imploded? Or is there anything we can do?
I think people realized that the fear that these people were generating was ridiculous. It didn't create anything. The people coming in found jobs. They created jobs. They were good neighbors. They were law-abiding. Didn't impact their political system. The fear, the issues that created the fear did not pan out.
So it's kind of like homosexuality. Once you became, you know someone that's gay,
right,
you became less afraid of them.
Exactly. You know, it's very easy to make people afraid of what they don't know. And when they realized that there was nothing to fear, there was no longer a reason to keep voting in people that were just continuing that fear-mongering. They just lost faith in their vision. They lost in the know-nothing nativist party vision, and they voted for others. Out of the seeds of the know-nothing party, however, some of the politicians got together and created the Republican Party. That doesn't mean it's the negative part of the know-nothing party. It was maybe other parts that people believed in. They created. And a big issue of the know-nothings, I believe, also was the issue of, you know, slavery.
They were against it?
Well, they were probably more for it.
Yeah,
they believed in white power.
Yeah.
But, you know, the whole issue of North-South rights became an issue. The Republican Party championed the freedom of the enslaved Americans. The Republican Party of the 19th century was all about protecting the rights of those that could not protect themselves. They were, you know, supporting the abolition of slavery. Somewhere in the early 20th century, some of the base beliefs of the Republican Party moved over to the Democratic Party, and some of the base beliefs of the then Democratic Party moved over to the Republican Party. So they kind of switched a little bit.
It was kind of in the 60s, wasn't it, with Goldwater and...
You look at Teddy Roosevelt, you know, he was a Republican. He was all about social reform.
Right.
He was all about it was under him that children's legislation came to be where kids could not work in factories under the age of 14.
He was about busting monopolies.
He wanted to break apart.
Sort of like today, there was corporations had amassed a huge amount of power and they were breaking them up, and he was the champion of that.
He was a huge champion. He was reviled by, you know, Rockefeller and, you know, Morgan, J.P. Morgan, all those guys that had these huge monopolies were making their fortunes off the backs of the people who had to work 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, with no benefits and no protections and poor working conditions. You know, Teddy Roosevelt, as a Republican, he was a champion of the man, of the common man. And then you had Franklin D. Roosevelt. He was a Democrat. He
had many of the same views, but it flipped sometime between there.
Somewhere between early 1900s and the 1930s. Well, you know, after the crash of
crash in World War I, I'm sure, were huge impacts on people.
It changed a lot of people's views. So all of a sudden you have FDR, who was a distant cousin, actually, of Teddy Roosevelt. And actually, Teddy Roosevelt's niece was Eleanor Roosevelt, who married FDR.
Right.
So the families were aligned in some fashion. They all knew each other back in the day.
And Hoover was a Republican in the 20s who was basically in favor of corporation control.
Right.
And that's what led to the crash.
I think that's where the swish.
So it must have been sometime between Hoover and Teddy Roosevelt.
Right.
Yeah.
And we see some parallels right now with our crazy markets right now, and there's been a lot written by economists about how we're mirroring things that happened in the 20s, which I hope not.
Well, just by, if you look at history, there's usually a recession every 10 years or so
yeah,
we're definitely
due.
So no matter who you think is to blame for that, I mean, it's just...
It's going to happen.
It's going to happen, yeah.
Well, because nothing stays on top forever.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's our dream that everything's going to be perfect, and we expect our politicians to make everything perfect, but the reality is we live in an economic cycle.
And usually when things are going well, they don't want to pass laws to regulate things because they don't want to mess up the things
going well.
And that
Absolutely.
Ends up messing it up because
yes.
things get out of control. I mean, it was the housing market 10 years ago.
Right.
Maybe it'll be the stock market this time that causes things to go. Ooh, who knows?
Gosh,
what
a scary thought. But so we can always look back at history, and we kind of can understand today a little bit by looking at what's happened in the past. And I think that's the big message that I like to put across through my stories, is that read history, because in history we will find answers to today's issues, because some things never really change. And hopefully we can avert some of the things we've done in the past from happening again in the present.
So we won't be doomed to repeat it, right? That's the
Unfortunately, we are men and women, and we seem to be a race that doesn't figure out these things, and we often repeat our mistakes, and sadly so. But, you know, history gives us an opportunity to at least be aware of our surroundings and of the opportunity to change, you know, our belief systems, our how we handle our neighbors, you know, how we handle the stresses of today's society, is to know that it's happened before and that we will survive if we work together. You know, regardless of our religious differences, our political differences, if we work together as a community, we can overcome.
All right. Thank you so much, Sylvia Hasenkopf. New column out Friday in the Greenville Pioneer. I think it's greenvillepioneer.com.
Yes.
And it's available at local Storts
and through subscription,
Hannaford's,
of course. And on Facebook, you can find some information. Yes.
Yeah. The Greenville Town Hall is where their offices are upstairs.
No, it's across. Andrea has her own storefront. You know, she has her own building that she's in. It's she shares it with the Greenville Ambulance God. So.
And do you have a website that we should mention too? Or
I'm on Facebook. I do have a website, North River Research, which is my research arm. But I also am on Facebook with Tracing Your Roots in Greene County. I also have North River Research. I also manage the Caro Historical Society Facebook page. And I also run the Tracing Your Roots in Greene County website, which is about Greene County history.
All right. Well, thank you for stopping by today at High, Low, and Catskill. And we'll see you next month.
Thank you, Tom.